You're listening to Law and Liberty, the official podcast of the Chalcedon Foundation, where we're proclaiming the authority of God's Word over every area of life and thought. Today, you are joined by your host, Martin Celbretti and Andrea Schwartz.
Welcome to this edition of the Law and Liberty podcast of the Chalcedon Foundation. My name is Andrea Schwartz. Today is February 3rd, 2010, and Martin Celbretti is joining me as we continue in our discussion of the chapters of R.J. Rushdoony's book, Law and Liberty. And today we will be discussing Chapter 4. His title of it is The Politics of Pornography. And we'll be discussing not only Dr. Rushdoony's thesis, but the implications of it for today. Welcome, Martin.
Good to be here, Andrea.
Good. Well, you know, pornography is not exactly a very upbeat subject. However, it's something that when Rush wrote this essay years ago, he was very prophetic in terms of what the implications would be. And then I believe after he wrote this chapter, he actually devoted an entire book that Chalcedon has available called Noble Savages. What's the big deal about pornography? And what did he see was the consequences of a society that not only tolerated it, but continued to promote it?
What he was concerned with was the implications that pornography had in the realm of human liberty. He believed that the pornographers were actually inverting the entire concept of liberty, and in the name of liberty were undercutting it. So that has tremendous consequences for us today, that there's a mode by which, through moral anarchism, we find the foundations for liberty being destroyed. And as a result of that, we are creating an environment in which the future is going to be defined in terms of a tyranny in the political realm. Now, that seems a stretch because we always tend to compartmentalize pornography as a moral issue regarding lasciviousness and things in this order, as a dirty sin here. Mm-hmm. But Rushdoony has shown that there's actually an undercurrent that dominates and shapes the intrusion of pornography into a culture. There's actually a worldview shift, the destruction and the undermining and the sapping of Christian self-government, or any form of self-government, but primarily is Christian self-government. In the old days, they used to call this a dissipating sin, that is a sin that removes your life force, the moral fiber or force in a person, and reduces them to a lower level. Well, that has political implications. It's a lowering into a lower level of subservience. Because if a nation is not going to be self-governed, then it must be externally governed. Then the regulators come in and we increase external government because of the destruction and the sapping of self-government.
Okay, well, let's kind of connect the dots here a bit, because it will sound to, I'm sure, people who are not versed in the implications of pornography, isn't it really more like a slippery slope that people, you're not talking about an intentional revolution in thought, an intentional shift in worldview. Isn't it just a consequence of people being too preoccupied with sex, or is this something intentional that's being thrust on the society?
Well, Rushdoony kind of was looking at the direction, why are we interested in this area, that is, this immoral aspect of sex? And the reason is we want to move these ancient landmarks, redefine the norms. Lots of times people will say, well, this is the norm today. Well, they're talking about a statistical norm, and they're treating nature and man's natural impulses as normal and constituting the good, as if nature were unfallen. The reality is that we need to speak in terms of an ethical norm, moral absolutes, not a natural but a supernatural source of law. And therefore, we have to take the fall of man seriously. And so there's a big worldview war here in evidence between the two positions. So it is not just this lascivious component over here It's not just the dirtiness, if you will, or the things that we normally associate with the obscene and the profane. It's rather actually a shift of norms, a changing of society.
And that deliberate. You're saying it's a deliberate change of society.
Yes, it ultimately is, because of the fact that the pornographer and the Christian are both made in the image of God, and one of them is doing their best to undermine it. And that ripples throughout the entire community. You know, we're told very clearly not to follow a multitude to do evil. And it's the nature that evil is going to spread its roots deeper and deeper into other areas. And I think Dr. Rushdoony has been very insightful in studying a very distasteful topic in the book Noble Savages.
Right.
To determine exactly what was the worldview of, say, the Marquis de Sade, or of other folks that have written on the topic of obscenity and its relationship to goodness. Mm-hmm. They trumpet a new liberty, a new freedom, and say freedom from law. But when they remove the self-governing component of the electorate, then the electorate falls under the weight and burden of a larger governmental system to control them. That's why Marxists have been very strong on pornography, because they're willing to argue for freedom in that arena, knowing that they'll give you with the right hand what they'll take away with the left, which is your political freedom. So it's part of an agenda across the board. Whether it's acknowledged or not does not change the fact of the agenda.
Right. I know in this particular chapter, he makes the categorical statement that pornography is hostile to biblical faith at its core. Mm-hmm. So when we see attacks on the definition of marriage, when we see attacks on whether or not what constitutes a family and what's normal in terms of people loving each other and being grouped together and such things, do those movements have their root in a similar thing of what you've just described?
Yeah, ultimately they do. I know that Dr. Rushdoony made reference when he spoke of the socialists specifically to the attack on the bourgeois monogamic family. We'd say monogamous, but the quote says monogamic.
Right.
And consequently, the targeting of that was through the vehicle of pornography. So they know very, very well what they are doing, and that these dissipating sins prepare a populace for totalitarianism.
Do you think that's behind the move to sexualize children in the state schools at such an early age, to make them preoccupied with sex and deviances and to explore their sexual freedom so that they will be a much more controllable populace?
Yes, dependencies can be inflicted on children at an earlier and earlier age. And therefore, they see freedom not in terms of political freedom, but in terms of sexual freedom. And then they see freedom in terms not of being under God's law, but repudiating God's law. They see freedom in a fallen nature versus in regeneration and a new nature.
Right. One of the things I think is extremely interesting is you have a culture that promotes promiscuity. They don't call it promiscuity. They just call it sexual liberation. Many of the heroes in movies or television are often people who are securing things for the country but are very loose in terms of their vows. And yet, when you have Christian families or large families, the people who are the same ones promoting sexual freedom find it disgusting that you'll have a family that might have 10 children or this Duggar family that has 19. They find it repulsive and abnormal, and yet they're not willing to say sexual freedom inside the context of a marriage is good. It only seems to be good if you're cutting edge and you're really alive, if you are doing things that are beyond the society's norms.
Part of the problem from the pornographer's side is when a child is born, that's responsibility, and there goes a little bit of your freedom and liberty as a consequence. So to have consequence-free sex is the goal. Consequence-free in terms of no consequences from God, so God is off the table so far as they're concerned. And again, this narrowing in of the definition of liberty into the sexual realm so that we can have the wool pulled over eyes in the area of true freedoms regarding property, regarding inheritance, taxation, the entire spectrum of political ramifications come to mind.
Right. Well, freedom and liberty are not synonymous terms, are they?
No, they are not.
Why don't you differentiate for us the differences from a biblical perspective?
Liberty is always in terms of being under God's law, under his government. In fact, I walk at liberty because I seek thy precepts is a statement right out of Psalm 119, the 45th verse. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty, we read in 2 Corinthians 3:17. So this concept is always tied to the authority of God. It's a derivative liberty. It's not an unlimited liberty. It is constrained. The only way that an airplane flies is because it has forces constraining it. Gravity down, lift up, thrust forward, and drag back. And that allows it to actually slip through the skies in the direction it's supposed to go. Then it has liberty. Mm-hmm. Take away any of those events, and we cannot control the plane, and therefore it's a chaotic crash of the plane. So constraint is always the framework, and in this case, it's a created realm. The universe is created with God's imprint upon it, his lawful imprint upon it, and therefore it obeys him in the moral realm no less than in the physical realm. Mm-hmm. So liberty is always within the framework of God's law, not outside of it. Outside of it, there might be licentiousness or freedom from God, but it's a false freedom because it's another form of slavery. Mm-hmm. You're then a slave to your sin nature. And this goes back to what we started with at the beginning, the denial of the fall of man, the notion of man is inherently good, and then finally the notion of nature, man's natural impulses as being idolized, put up on the pedestal as good, and anything that conflicts with those natural impulses, bad. Therefore, according to the Marquis de Sade, the only real evil is Christianity because it gets in the way of these natural impulses which need to be indulged.
It's interesting that you say that because repeatedly within the state schools, they'll allow almost anything other than abstinence education. First of all, they'll make the ridiculous statement that abstinence doesn't work. Of course, that is tied in with an evolutionary perspective on people that we're really just more advanced animals, and to tell young people that they shouldn't have sexual relations until they're in a covenanted marriage, they consider that they'll miss out on life and that we're actually hampering people and giving them false restraints.
Well, if you have a lowest common denominator morality, which is what the public schools seem to sink to, almost institutionally so, by constitutional mandate as the way they're made up, not U.S. Constitution, but the way they're constituted, I don't think that you can ever stop that downward pull toward that goal that promiscuity needs to be protected in terms of consequences, but any kind of self-government imposed on the students is laughed at. So they look for these symptomatic fixes, but not a substantive moral fix. And of course, we have very strong issues about the state schools existing in the first place. But setting that issue aside, we would not expect them to be able to give moral guidance insofar as they are not an instrument for providing moral guidance to the students. If anything, they're an instrument for essentially implementing, getting the camel's nose under the tent, the whole notion of the politics of pornography as Dr. Rushdie sees it. That is, moral anarchy can be protected, but moral absolutes must be thrust out of the system. And so they're very good at it. They've done exactly that to move everything to a lowest common denominator and to de-Christianize the entire system. Now, again, I'm not arguing for the existence of these state schools.
Right.
But they have definitely become internally consistent to their original purpose, which is to shape a future electorate, that is docile, pliable, and can be managed according to social theory.
Right. It's the ultimate creation of the city of man, and if you eliminate any reference to or any appeal to the scripture, Christ, atoning death and, you know, living by God's law, since those are eliminated, what's left is this spirit of revolution.
Correct. For example, they do not mind referring to the moral position as prudish, but God forbid if a Christian should use any strong language to define the immoral position on the other side. Then all of a sudden, those judgmental statements reprehended, and the Christian is guilty of all manner of politically incorrect speech at that point.
Right. You know, I remember many times having discussions with Rush Dooney about various topics, and he seemed to feel that the Marquis de Sade was a pivotal figure, and yet I don't think many people on a day-to-day basis think much about it, nor are they even very familiar. Would you explain a little bit to our listeners what the Marquis de Sade was all about, what he stood for, and the kind of influence that he's had?
Fundamentally, he was a man who believed in power from below, from the natural urges that comprise us, and he saw them as ultimately good. He felt that it was necessary to take away all restraints because they represent artifice. They are artificial restraints that are arbitrary, that are the inheritance of ages of moral prudishness and absolutes that need to be thrust aside. In essence, he represents part of that second psalm, let us cast his cords from us. Mm. And he felt that defined not only true freedom, but was the source of power in man. And that power could then take the form of the power of one man over another man or over a woman, particularly. And this was this raw form of power which was glorified. And he lived very consistently with his position. And therefore, he makes a very, very good test case for Rush Dooney. What most people don't know is that even if the most extreme elements of de Sade's position are not necessarily front and center in our culture, they are driving it from underneath, mm-hmm. and they are there, and we don't recognize the evil of it. In fact, let me say that real quickly here, is that Dr. Rushdie made it very clear we have become so morally compromised, we are not willing to look at someone and say, this is evil, or you are evil. To say that is the only evil, basically. We have a complete inversion so that we cannot actually voice a moral judgment, even if God's word is very clear on it.
Exactly.
Even if the consequences of, and so by trading out a biblical morality for a new conventional morality premised on the abandonment of Christian self-government of biblical law, our whole culture has shifted in its shape to something radically different. And moral anarchism therefore creates a framework for the loss of freedom. Ironically, you cannot get freedom directly. It is a consequence of obeying God's law.
Right, because he makes the very strong statement that moral anarchism is the tool and instrument of totalitarianism, socialism, and dictatorship, and that the rise of totalitarianism is always preceded by moral anarchism.
Yes, because then at that point we need to have the external government tighten its grip, because the people have loosened their own grip. You know, in fact, it's interesting. We always talk about that verse in the Proverbs, where there's no vision, the people perish. But he who keepeth the law, happy is he. The people perish can also be rendered, the people run wild.
Uh-huh.
And it's contrasted with he who keeps the law, happy is he. Running uninhibited or wild versus true blessing under God. So that's paradigmatic. That's exactly where we need to focus on.
Right. Well, explain this for me then. Why do you think news of important figures, whether they be politicians or sports figures or celebrities of some sort, they're being caught in adultery, their affairs, as we like to call adultery today in modern parlance, why is that such a big news? In other words, are people schizophrenic on this point? We should have this kind of freedom, but it's big news and everybody thinks it's awful when someone is caught in the act?
Well, there's actually a hidden interior joy that if God is grading on the curve, this is good news, because the more people who can bring the curve down, the better off we are. We look at examples of celebrities and say, well, I'm not like that man. I'm not as bad as such and so. My marriage is still intact, or my second or third marriage is still intact, whatever the statement may be.
Uh-huh.
Or I'm not quite as bad as X, Y, or Z. So by creating, again, this ambient environment where there's a general depression and an acceptance that, you know, celebrities, they always go off the deep end. In fact, the big news is a celebrity that has an intact first marriage. mm-hmm. for 30, 40 years or something that's ordered. That's extraordinary. It's like they didn't get the message. They had the power to do what they wanted, and for some reason they settled for second best. In fact, Rushduni goes through the notion that lots of times people have affairs not because they're not content with their spouse, but because they think they're missing out on something special and they don't want time to pass them by.
Right.
So rather than being content with the wife of their youth, they're looking for something else because they think they're being deprived of some kind of false pleasure. And, of course, it's a pleasure that bites back with venom.
Right.
But so, I believe, yeah, the news reports are out there because there's a general joy that the standards are dropping. And consequently, the more reports we have like this, the more, one, it becomes more acceptable. And two, we don't look so bad if everyone is doing it. And that's why I referred to that verse from Exodus 23, do not follow the multitude to do evil. The more we see it looking like a multitude, and of course the media can make anything look like a multitude just by putting it out there 24/7.
Sure.
And in fact, there are entire tabloids that are dedicated to putting that in our face as we are checking out of the grocery stores.
Right.
That is a desensitization effect. And basically it means everyone's doing it, therefore, why not? So all the moral barriers inside us that would guard our hearts against these actions, they start to be attacked because we are looking at what other people are doing. We are looking at what our leaders are doing. And we draw the false conclusion from them that that's the norm. But it's only a statistical norm. It is not an ethical norm.
Right. That's an important point. Well, what about within the church? Recently in our area, a rather large church saw the pastor step down, the person who was pretty much the point man in terms of having the church grow to the size it grew to and moving to bigger facilities, etc. Would you say that within the context of the church, it's just paralleling the culture, or do you think there's something more to that?
Well, part of the problem with the churches is they themselves have abandoned God's law. They are not creating a flock that is self-governing. In other words, they're not equipping the flock for every good work in righteousness and reproof and instruction and righteousness, etc. So the churches are ill-equipped to handle these things. In fact, the general premise of the church is not restitution, but rather forgiveness. And It is a blind forgiveness. It is a false absolution, as Dr. Rushduni calls it in his book, The Cure of Souls, which I regard as a must-read for anyone interested in this entire area. I'm just going to throw a plug in for The Cure of Souls,
Another
posthumously written book by Dr. Rushduni. And it's significant because...
Well, posthumously printed. He wrote it before he died.
As we can tell, he wrote it before he died.
Right, yeah.
But there are passages in the Bible about Elijah doing things after he died, so I'm not so sure sometimes about Rush's...
Well, passage. I don't know. That manuscript was sitting in his desk. We have to give it. We have to say he wrote it before he died.
Right. But he makes an interesting point there, and I think it deals with the churches in a big way. He says the pastors are looked at a falling marriage, and instead of dealing with the sin, they make the priority saving the marriage, not dealing with the sin.
Oh, that is so true. It locally, The way in which the pastor resigned is he sent a letter of resignation. He didn't call it, he wasn't specific. He called it a moral failure, and that this was a matter between him and his wife. And he was going to work on his marriage. And then if you had gone to the fan page of this particular pastor on Facebook, there was not one person that even questioned the idea that this was just a personal sin, that it had anything to do with greater magnitude, that it was actually a very public sin as opposed to just a private sin.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was, I know he'll be back preaching, God wants to restore him, et cetera, but it was just so obvious there's no mention of biblical consequences for actions.
I'd like to know how they know that God wants to restore him to office.
That well, because he was so popular and everybody loved him.
Oh, that trumps the scriptures. I see.
Absolutely.
You know, I just last night was looking through a text about restoring fallen pastors, pastors guilty of serious sexual clergy abuse and things in this order. And the book made virtually no reference to any Old Testament texts, but continued to focus on New Testament ones and kept drawing the conclusion there doesn't seem to be much evidence here that would prevent them from being restored, except right. inferences about the high office, high calling, et cetera, et cetera. So they couldn't dig into the passages in Ezekiel 34 that actually would forbid restoration to office. Right. The Old Testament law is alien to them, like Ephraim esteemed God's law, the marvelous things in it, as a strange thing. So, too, the modern church has no clue what to do with this kind of situation on the part of their leaders. And consequently, the leaders are put back in office.
Right.
And God's assertion that they shall no longer feed off the flock, in other words, make their living ministering and shepherding the flock ever again, it's a permanent barring. That's totally lost sight of.
And I'm sure in a lot of these cases, they're given a nice severance package because the church doesn't want to be sued or something. And it's just it's just so distasteful to me because, you know, we know from the scriptures that judgment begins in the house of the Lord. And if we're going to try to have any kind of influence in the greater society, our house definitely needs to be in order.
Yeah, indeed. there's no question that...
Okay, let me just change the realm of the discussion here. Rush says in the book that the politics of pornography is simply the politics of revolution, and pornography is an excellent come-on for the stupid and immature, that its underlying purpose is not evident to them, but it's nothing less than revolution. Would you say that when you look at the results of recent national elections, that we really had people who fell into the category of the stupid and immature voting for something that was, from their way of thinking, just different, and they felt good about voting for this man for president because somehow or other, I heard people actually say it made up for the Civil War and slavery.
Well, K.L. Seton is technically not political. Uh-huh. In fact, I regard us as supra-political. We sit basically in judgment on all the parties because God's law sits over them, and we believe we are called to at least explain it and apply it the best we can. Mm-hmm. But I must say the idea that the electorate can be stupid or is kind of means we need to apologize to stupid people for that comment. And by stupid, I'm talking about actually a moral stupidity.
Right.
Rather than intellectual, because we certainly live in an age of high intellectual achievement. Some very well-schooled people, I should say, hold very strong views, but all these views exhibit world views, perspectives and positions that are at war with even our own nature. It's a denial of the truths that actually control and govern this world. And so our political situation is a reflection of our desire for a Messiah. In fact, in effect, we're seeing that looking toward Washington is a very key evidence of our willingness to give away power and to concentrate it in the hands of people that we trust to resolve our problems. For example, we want to have this economy fixed, but not the way that it actually needs to be fixed, rather to take away the consequences of a badly corrupted, abominable currency and economic system through the Federal Reserve that's destroying us. And we've made ourselves, in effect, the victims of our own lust for money. Mm-hmm. You know, as Rushdie says in Enlarging the Heart, we would not have the system we have today unless we enjoyed the prerogatives and the blessings, so-called, of debauching our currency and inflating its value so we can pay off debts, future debts, in cheaper dollars. And
right.
Therefore, no one really wants to fix the problem. We really want to continue to defraud banks by paying off those debts. So, too, that's a form of slavery, if you will. Our lust for money creates a system. So our lust in the sexual realm also creates a system as well, at least a framework in which the state expands, and tries to meet our needs. And the state then becomes the champion of sexual freedoms, but the enemy of true freedoms.
Right. So, okay, we're coming to the end of our time now. I guess if I were putting myself in the position of many, I would say, okay, so what does the average person, what does the average family do in order to counter this march towards socialism in terms of the idea of how far our culture has deviated from its original roots as in our republic. I mean, it's so easy to feel impotent in this area, but I know you have an opinion to the contrary that we're anything but impotent.
No, it doesn't take but 10% of the populace, as Dr. Rashtuni said, to essentially guide the future and to shape the future. It just has to be a group that is committed and sold out on its principles. And so the solution resides first in individuals who are willing, like Job, to make a covenant with their eyes and to not look lustfully at a woman. That's square one, that men and women hold their vessel in honor, as it were. So we start at the individual, then the family becomes a safe cocoon for preparing people, for alerting them in advance, to equip them so that they can, in fact, bat off these fiery darts of the enemy, and we have to consider it that that's exactly what they are, and then to undertake the reconstruction of our legal system. Psalm 94:20 says that the wicked frame mischief using law. So the various laws have been put in effect to break down these barriers. It's actually a legal revolution after it becomes a mental revolution in the mind of the society. What becomes culturally acceptable then becomes legally enforced. And so we have to push back in all these areas and reaffirm absolutes, reaffirm ethical norms, reaffirm the law of God without apology. And Christians have no tools if they throw away the law of God. They just have the gospel. And though as blessed as that is, it is not sufficient in itself to rectify the problem. We need the standards of God's law because that's what's under attack. The gospel is not so much under attack as it is the standards of God's law that is under attack.
Right.
And to ethics, if you will.
And the gospel was never meant to exist apart from God's law.
No.
Because it's not good news if we're not saved from God's wrath, and he's made it clear what he expects in terms of his people receiving blessings and what he promises for a violation of the law in the form of cursings. And when you get people to seriously read Deuteronomy 28 and take it for what it is, it's a wake-up call for those whose hearts are tender to really pursuing kingdom work.
Correct. I believe in that chapter we're discussing today, Rashtuni quotes about the idea that the sin, these sexual sins, are actually a trifle. And he quotes, I believe, from the song where the seductress wipes her mouth and says, "I have done no wrong." Uh-huh. But it's interesting is that that whole sequence in Proverbs is a warning to young men to not stray into that situation in the first place. Again, self-government is presupposed there, and that needs to be inculcated. We need to reestablish the moral backbone. We have to get away from invertebrate Christianity fast.
Right.
Or we're in big trouble, or as some have called it, the evangelifish phenomenon. We need a backbone. We need moral courage. And it doesn't matter if the culture doesn't lack it. Of course it doesn't. It says the darkness hates the light. And we know that the darkness will not comprehend or sink the light. We can take confidence in the statement in 1 John 2:8 that the darkness is passing away and the true light is shining already. There's a battle between the zones of the dark and the light, but the light is pressing forward and will eventually broaden into the fullness of day. The other side is on the losing side, ultimately losing side. And we need to realize that we can be more than conquerors and that Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil. That includes pornography, is to be destroyed.
Exactly.
And we need to be forthright and not cowards and not wimpy weaklings in regard to this battle, and to see it for what it is, a worldview battle that is a designed revolution to oust Christianity and biblical law.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right. Well, thank you. To our listeners, the book that we're going through is entitled Law and Liberty. It's available from the Chalcedon Store, www.chalcedonstore.com. You can also go to our website, calcedon.edu, or faithforalloflife.com, if that's easier for you to remember. And then another book we've referenced today, actually two, Noble Savages, which goes into greater detail on the implications of pornography and its effect and its march, so to speak, to totalitarianism. And then also Martin referenced Larceny in the Heart, which talks about the aspect of our economic system. We hope you join us again in the future. Please pass this podcast and distribute it widely, because the only way that we're going to see a turnaround will be when God's law once again is in place in the hearts and minds of Christians, and liberty will then follow. Thank you, Martin, and I look forward to our conversation in the future.
Very good, Andrea. Thanks.